You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll learn about a charitable pharmacy in Madison where hundreds of low-income, uninsured people are getting their medical prescriptions filled for free.
First, a chunk of ice the size of Delaware broke off from the Antarctic Peninsula this week. It's one of the largest icebergs ever recorded. The release of this iceberg has reduced the size of the ice shelf.
Scientists are concerned that this ice shelf will eventually collapse, and they think if it loses much more area, it could allow more glaciers to flow out into the ocean. But that might be decades away.
Matthew Lazara is an associate scientist and research meteorologist at the Antarctic Meteorological Research Center in UW-Madison's Space Science and Engineering Center. He also teaches climate and weather courses at Madison Area Technical College. Matthew, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Well, help us visualize this Larsen C ice shelf. What is it?
So if you were to get in your car, say, up in Appleton, and drive all the way down to Racine, that's about how long this iceberg is. In the other direction, it's pretty much the north to south direction of, say, Dane County. So that gives you an idea of this, something that's just a bit under 100 miles long by as wide as about 30, 31 miles in the other direction. So fairly big piece.
And why is it called the Larsen C Ice Shelf?
Ah, that's a good question. So let's look at the two parts of that. Larsen is actually the name of a Norwegian whaling captain, and he was one of the first to see this part of the Antarctic. Now, the Larsen Ice Shelf is actually part of the Antarctic Peninsula. There's several embayments. And so they've subdivided the different embayments and lettered them A, B, and C. And so this is the C portion of it.
And so A and B, there have been some breakups and things like that. Is that right?
Correct. Yeah, that's right. We no longer have a Larsen A and B shelf, or there's only little remnants left of B. I guess B was well known to have collapsed some years ago, and back in the 1990s, A had collapsed. And so C is the largest of the embayments, and of course, this is the very first fairly large breakup that we've seen in modern times.
And you do a lot of research on Antarctica. Have you been there?
Yes, I have been. I've deployed 9 times to the Antarctic, but I've not been to this particular ice shelf, although I've been to other ice shelves, like the Rice Ice Shelf is one of the largest on the continent.
What is it like there this time of year?
It's winter, so it's dark, sun's not up at all, and it is cold, and in particular stormy. In fact, the United States main station has had some really significant stormy weather the last few days.
So help us wrap our heads around a trillion-ton iceberg. What happened here with this massive hunk of ice breaking off? When did the break start?
So the way ice works in the Antarctic is actually always moving. Even though you don't think of ice as something that's moving, it's actually very slowly collecting from the snow on the top of the continent, and it flows out on these glaciers which go out onto the ice shelves. Now, the ice, it's brittle. It does have what are known as rifts or cracks in it. And so they slowly start to pair up and then begin the formation of what then turns into these icebergs. So this actual beginning of the rifting of this iceberg probably began decades ago. Only perhaps in the last, say, 6-7 years have we really been able to notice it very clearly from satellite and observations of folks who've been flying over the region. So this is something that's been long coming.
A lot of talk about what this means for climate change. Is climate change to blame here?
Not clearly. Ice shelves are interesting in that they, to maintain their size, there needs to be these big, large, and we call these, by the way, tabular icebergs. They need to form, and calve off every, and because of their size and how long it takes them to form, because this isn't stuff that's moving very fast. It's something that happens every, say, 50 to 100 years. Now, having said that's something that would be not a climate change issue, just the way the glaciological, in fact, the hydrological, frozen hydrological cycle works in the Antarctic. There are still some things going on, like, for example, the Larsen B ice shelf, that do have climate implications. And here, when you start to calve off big pieces of ice like this, then what's behind it, what's left of the ice shelf and the glaciers behind that, will they start to become more susceptible to their breakup perhaps sooner than they might have otherwise in the current changing climate that we do have. That's unknown, and so this is why this isn't very clear-cut or a definitive, yes, this is a climate change thing. It's got more dimension to it than that.
We're talking right now with Matthew Lazara. He's an associate scientist and research meteorologist at the Antarctic Meteorological Research Center that is based here at UW-Madison, and it's UW-Madison Space Science and Engineering Center. We're talking about this massive iceberg that broke off this week from an ice shelf in Antarctica. Matthew, what does this mean for sea level rise?
Actually, not that much. You can actually try this at home when you put some ice cubes in a floating in a glass. As the ice melts, it doesn't really change the level very much because that ice is already displacing the amount of ocean that it's going to be when the iceberg then turns into water. So there is some subtle changes, but for the most part, nothing of any consequence. The bigger concern will be if we do see actual ice, for example, say further up the ice shelf that's up on land, when that comes down and then contributes to sea level, that's when you do see sea level rise. But for this particular iceberg, no change.
And what will you and other scientists around the world be watching for in the coming months, the coming years, as this iceberg just does its thing?
Yeah, so there's two parts. We'll have an interesting time watching the iceberg as it does go about its float out into the Southern Ocean. And we'll see what it does there. But we'll also keep an eye on where it came from. We'll be watching Larsen C to see how the rest of that ice shelf behaves. Will it remain the way it is, or will we start to see it have other, other breakups and other changes in the coming years? And this is something that actually the National Ice Center here in the United States, they monitor a lot of the icebergs in the Antarctic. In fact, they've actually formally named it today. It is known as A68.
That's just today, news today.
That's correct.
Matthew, what about your research in Antarctica? What are you studying?
So I'm the principal investigator in charge of all of the United States automatic weather stations that run across the continent. So that's it's quite a few, actually. It's just a bit under 60 stations. That's over or roughly half of all of the automatic weather stations running in Antarctica. So I'm really trying to capture the surface meteorology, the surface climate of Antarctica, so we can understand how the weather works, how the climate works, and we can get a sense of how that is evolving and changing in time. And I occasionally also use satellite observations, which makes it really great to be able to watch things like icebergs, but also clouds and storms and get a sense of how they're changing as well.
Yeah, how have satellites impacted research like yours and so many other scientists?
So we would never really have a sense of these big tabular icebergs without satellites. They're priceless. I mean, at this time of year, very few people are doing any transportation or running around the Antarctic because it is winter. The few folks who are there are hunkered down in actual main stations, and we would never really see this. And so they give us a real bird's-eye view of seeing these massive icebergs calve off of the Antarctic. Back in 2000, we got to do the same thing in the Ross Sea, watch some of the largest icebergs ever form there, iceberg called B15. And so they're really priceless in being able to monitor this part of the world.
Very quickly, as we wrap up, why do you love to study Antarctica, and what keys to the scientific world does it possess?
Well, it is a pretty place, and once you get the chance to visit, you kind of fall in love with the scenery and such. But it does provide an awful lot about, the Antarctic is kind of like a temperature or a thermostat for the planet. It kind of regulates it. And so that's why it's really important for all of us everywhere, is getting a sense of understanding how that works so we understand how our whole Earth works.
Matthew, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Matthew Lazara is an associate scientist and research meteorologist at the Antarctic Meteorological Research Center in UW-Madison's Space Science and Engineering Center. He also teaches climate and weather courses at Madison Area Technical College. He was telling us about that massive iceberg that broke off of an ice shelf in Antarctica this week. hundreds of low-income, uninsured patients receive their prescriptions for free from a pharmacy in Madison. The St. Vincent de Paul Charitable Pharmacy is the only one of its kind in Wisconsin. The pharmacy has filled thousands of prescriptions this year, partnering with the UW School of Pharmacy, whose students volunteer there.
But the pharmacy is at a crossroads as a replacement for Obamacare might be on the way. This could mean many more people coming to its doors who need medications to manage chronic conditions like asthma, high blood pressure, and diabetes.
Yolanda Tolson-Yvonne is managing pharmacist at the St. Vincent de Paul Charitable Pharmacy. Yolanda, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Kate.
Well, walk us through how someone would typically become a patient at this charitable pharmacy and get their meds filled for free.
Okay, first of all, we have a two-step process. The first step would be the financial screening. So we have people prove that they are uninsured and have an income at or below 200% of the federal poverty level. Once that we have a signed statement with that taking place, then they are eligible for 30 days of access to the medications that we have available in the pharmacy.
Go ahead.
Okay. Yeah. And then after that, we ask that they provide proof of that. So they have 30 days to bring in the proof of that, that they're uninsured and that their income is at or below 200% of the federal poverty level. So for a single person, that would be about an income, a gross income of about $2,000. Once that proof has been determined, then we give them access to the pharmacy medications that we have available for 6 months.
Take us back to when the charitable pharmacy opened its doors. It's April 2013. And how have you seen the needs change over the past 4 years?
I would say that the needs have been steady. We did experience a significant drop in need for prescriptions after the Affordable Care Act. Our volume actually plummeted because people were able to get access to insurance, that they needed, yes, so
yeah.
Greatly. However, we have seen a slight uptick, a steady uptick, actually, of people needing insurance. And now our numbers, unfortunately, are actually almost as high as they were back in 2014.
And with people, when they come in and they fill their prescriptions, they also get a little health check or some FaceTime with the pharmacist. There is some back and forth. What happens when the patient comes in to fill their medications?
Well, I think one of the things that we really try to do is really teach how to provide care with care. We consider ourselves safety net providers. We consider ourselves to be the option of last resort, but we hope to be the best of the last. And so what we're hoping to do is provide the patients that come to our space care with dignity. We do take their blood pressures. We do check in with them. And sometimes we may be talking to them about non-medication related issues, but really issues that still affect their health.
And so you're taking blood pressures, you're asking them, have they had changes in their life and in their health?
Exactly. How things have been going. It's not uncommon for us to hug our patients. It's really more relationship driven. And we see ourselves as advocates for the patients that we serve.
Have you had to turn people away?
There have been times that we have had to turn people away because we do really try to help the neediest of the needy, those that really don't have any other option. That's really our primary focus. But we certainly want to also be a resource for others. We can refer people to other resources if we're unable to help them.
We're talking right now with Yolanda Tolson-Yvonne, who is managing pharmacist at the St. Vincent de Paul Charitable Pharmacy that is based here in Madison. And it is a pharmacy that is charitable in the sense it helps people fill their prescriptions to manage many chronic conditions like asthma, high blood pressure, and diabetes, and get these prescriptions filled for free. Yolanda, we don't know what's going to happen to the Affordable Care Act, but based on the Senate's health care bill to repeal and replace Obamacare, can you give it any prediction on how this would impact the charitable pharmacy?
Well, I believe that our numbers will continue to rise, probably significantly. We have seen a great uptick even in the last couple of months. We typically fill about 50 prescriptions a day, and just this last week we've been filling about 75 each day. So people are becoming aware of us, and the needs remain. we are having more people come to us that have more expensive needs in terms of needing insulin and inhalers. And so the need for us to find, you know, wonderful volunteers and financial support is also on the rise.
How does the partnership work then with UW School of Pharmacy?
So we've been very honored to be working with the School of Pharmacy. What has ended up developing in the pharmacy is really something that's kind of evolved organically into a nurturing environment. We have pharmacy students and also students that are considering pharmacy as a career that come and work with us. But we're also blessed to have folks that have that are near retirement or are have retired in their chosen healthcare profession. So we have retired pharmacists, we have retired nurses, we have physicians, we have a whole host of dedicated and interested folks, both in the community and the school, which really create a wonderful team.
How did you get involved?
So I've always had a heart and a passion for helping those that are, you know, in need of help. And I think I work at the pharmacy school, too. And one of the things I interview pharmacy students, and that's one of the things that they often say, why did you choose pharmacy as a profession? And so the desire to help is something that's always, you know, I think that's common among a lot of people that are interested in pharmacy and in healthcare in general. So,
and if the St. Vincent de Paul Charitable Pharmacy didn't exist, where would these patients, where would these people go to get their medications?
Well, I think that we would probably see a rise in emergency room visits and looking to the emergency rooms for the primary care. What we're hoping to do is try to be coordinators of care as safety net health providers to really help not compete against anyone, but really take care of the people that are really being seen across all systems, coordinating their care so that it really helps reduce costs for everyone.
And the people who are filling their prescriptions, they have this prescription from a physician, so they've been to the doctor.
They have
primary care provider.
They do. Sometimes, yes. We have some free and charitable clinics in the city. We have Access Community Health Center, too, which is a federally qualified health center, too. And so it is, in spite of people having insurance or if they don't have insurance, the costs prevent people from filling prescriptions sometimes. So if they did not have a pharmacy with St. Vinny's, it would really be tragic.
Do we have any idea how many people out there are forgoing their physician-prescribed medications because they simply can't afford the cost?
Yes, the Kaiser Family Health estimated that about 20% of uninsured folks forego treatment because they just simply feel that they can't afford it.
And for the patients who come to your doors, have they talked at all about foregoing their prescriptions and not taking their meds?
Yes, rationing their meds or maybe taking care of their children and not taking care of themselves. It's really some difficult choices that they have to make.
So you see it as well?
Mm-hmm. We do.
And how is their health doing once they get on to your pharmacy and once they start with a charitable pharmacy? Do you see differences?
We do see differences because I think we're also developing relationships and really getting to know the patients, and we can kind of check in. When people are receiving episodic care, there really is no one really kind of making sure and keeping tabs on folks to make sure that they're doing okay. So I think we consider that we have a very important role.
As a pharmacist, what have you learned through this charitable pharmacy? What has it taught you?
One of the things that it's taught me is it's really actually reemphasized the whole saying that it takes a village. It really takes, there are a lot of unsung heroes. Myself and Cheryl, we are the two paid staff for this pharmacy, but the rest of the folks that work in our pharmacy are completely volunteers. So when you have people that are there because they desire to be rather than because they have to be, the energy is just very positive, and it really makes a difference for the patients.
And for the students, the UW School of Pharmacy students, and some are in internships there.
Yes, yes,
how
yes.
long is their stay or their stint with the charitable pharmacy?
So we have a summer scholar program when we have students here for 10 weeks with us, and they each work on developing a different project that will really help kind of lay a brick into the foundation of the pharmacy.
What have some of those projects been?
So currently the projects that we have that we're working on is one is a blood pressure tracking system where patients can actually track their blood pressure with an app. And we can kind of keep tabs on how they're doing and make recommendations. Another is working on therapeutic interchange, a collaborative practice with a provider to be able to switch patients that are on more expensive insulins to products that we can get through patient assistance programs. And the third is there is a new app that's going to be developed that's regarding what's called HealthLink. And we will be working in partnership to kind of connect people with resources based upon their zip code.
What do you see, Yolanda, that the next step is for the St. Vincent de Paul Charitable Pharmacy? Where does it go from here?
Well, I think we need to continue to collaborate with partners throughout the city. The need continues, and we want to be a part of the solution.
Who might be some of those partners?
We are working with the Medic, the UW Medical School. They have a program called Medic, and they have medical students, pharmacy students, interdisciplinary teams working and seeing patients. So we're trying to develop a referral process with them. We are trying to expand some of the diabetes care that we provide beyond just medications, but to looking into nutrition and other aspects that pertain to health and wellness. And finally, we are also trying to teach the whole idea that health does not occur in a vacuum. So the social determinants of health, looking at shelter and all of those other things that impact a person's ability to be well. We want to consider that and teach students about that as well.
Well, Yolanda, thank you so much for taking the time and being with us here today.
Thank you so much. It's been an honor.
Yolanda Tolson-Yvonne is managing pharmacist at the St. Vincent de Paul Charitable Pharmacy here in Madison.
Coming up, we'll look at the latest version of the Republican Senate health care bill. Some changes, some things are the same. We'll find out what's going on. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.
Senate Republicans unveiled a revised version of their health care bill today. The bill to replace the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, could come to a vote as soon as next week.
The revised bill is one that is likely to please conservatives, but moderates and Democrats are still likely to take issue with it. Cuts to Medicaid would begin in about 8 years, and according to the Congressional Budget Office, those changes will result in 15 million fewer people enrolled in the program.
Joining us now for a look at the impact of these changes and more is Donna Friedsam. She's a researcher and health policy director at UW-Madison's Population Health Institute. Donna, welcome back.
Good to be with you.
Well, it's like a biweekly or monthly conversation we're having about the latest health care bill. But looking at this one, before we dig into the details, big picture, how different is this bill from the last time we talked to you?
Well, it retains the large body of provisions that were in the previous Senate health bill, including the name of the previous bill, but it does have some significant changes, four principal changes that I'm happy to go through with you.
Now let's talk about some of the changes, and a big one people have been talking about is coming from mainly Senator Ted Cruz, apparently allowing companies that have healthcare plans on the exchange meeting the conditions of the exchange to have stripped down cheaper plans that don't meet all those conditions. Can you talk about that?
Right. So it would allow companies to, if they provide at least one plan on the exchange that meets the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare requirements, it could also offer plans that are not compliant with the requirements of Obamacare. So it would be, those plans would be exempt from community rating and guaranteed availability and requirements that bar insurers from denying coverage for pre-existing conditions or varying premiums based on health status and the like. And it also would require, or insurers would not have to offer a set of essential health benefits and certain protections against catastrophic costs.
Right, and as I understand it, the pro on that is young, healthy people would have a cheap alternative that would cover kind of the worst case stuff, but maybe not much else. But then a lot of people are pointing to it saying, in effect, you'd end up with a two-tiered system where coverage for people with pre-existing conditions or other health concerns, things could get more expensive for them. How do you break that down?
It seems that what it essentially is doing is turning the marketplace coverage of the Obamacare protections within the marketplace into a high-risk pool, and then and essentially separating, making two separate markets, one for people, the healthier, younger people who want to buy really minimal coverage at low prices, and another market within the Obamacare marketplace for people who perhaps need more comprehensive coverage and need to get and if they qualify for subsidies, they could get that on the Obamacare marketplace, even though it will be very expensive.
What does that do to the market ultimately if we end up with that kind of two-part system?
So the big concern there is, let me just say first that it would have the effect, indeed, of providing opportunities for very reduced price coverage for healthier, younger people than perhaps they can get today, but it would also be coverage that covers a lot less than what they might imagine would be covered under the existing protections that the ACA offers. So that would be exposing them to things that costs that they might not have anticipated if something does happen to them. And as well, it would expose them to very high deductibles and cost sharing. That being said, the people that would need more comprehensive coverage, they would have to they would see themselves purchasing it through the Obamacare marketplaces that still have all those consumer protections, but that the price of that coverage will get very expensive because there's not, the risk is not being pooled with the younger, healthier people any longer. Now, because there are federal subsidies available for people at lower incomes below 350% of the federal poverty level, those people might be somewhat protected from some of those increasing costs. But some other changes in the Senate bill that existed even before today's amendments suggests that there's going to be a lot higher exposure even for those people within the Obamacare marketplace to higher prices with this change.
Talking to Donna Friedstrom from UW-Madison's Population Health Institute, looking at the latest version of the Senate health care plan that would replace parts of the Affordable Care Act. You mentioned four substantial changes from the previous Senate version, assuming that Ted Cruz one we were just talking about was one of the big ones. What are the other key changes as you see them?
Well, there is a substantial provision to allow people to purchase coverage from within their health savings accounts. That's pre-tax money. And a number of analysts see that as a very substantial tax break, particularly for upper-income people who are more likely to be able to have the discretionary dollars to be able to contribute to an HSA. But on the other hand, HSAs are a purchasing vehicle for supporting health expenses and maybe something that provides more flexibility for people who want to have more choice in what kinds of coverage they purchase. There are some funds that have been added to the existing bill to support opioid prevention and treatment, about $45 billion in funding, and there has been about $70 billion in funding added for market stabilization that would go to insurance companies to help them handle what senators anticipate to be higher costs associated with the number of people that are going to be needing coverage that won't be able to afford the coverage through the existing subsidies.
And those stabilization funds, I mean, that's been an issue with the Affordable Care Act. Democrats have accused Republicans, once they got control of the Senate and House, of not providing those kind of funds that the Affordable Care Act was kind of based on. Is that right?
There's been a lot of debate about what kind of stabilization funds are required, and the House bill and the Senate bill, the first version of the Senate bill and now this Senate bill, have slowly increased the funding for market stabilization. But now it's starting to suggest that perhaps what is now being called market stabilization is what was previously under the Obamacare mechanism, the risk reinsurance and risk adjustment and risk corridors program, is considered to be, from some senators' perspectives, a giveaway to the insurance industry, from other people's perspective, a way to make up for the losses that will be experienced because of insufficient funding for people to be able to support or purchase their coverage because of the subsidies are not well enough supported. So there's a great debate about why these kinds of stabilization funds are needed. And so we don't have much agreement yet about whether, number one, whether we should have them, and number two, whether if we need them, is this enough money for them?
And then people in the previous version, one of the big concerns was a couple of different changes to Medicaid, lowering funding levels compared to the current projections from what they'd be, say, over the next 10 years or so, and also whether that would be something done directly from the federal government versus block grants to the states. What does Medicaid look like in this new Senate proposal?
There have been no substantial changes to the Medicaid provisions. The Medicaid program is still slated to take about a very substantial cut, really about a 35% cut over a decade, and with states having the option of going to a block grant or a per capita cap, and a very significant reductions in the federal participation in the state in its share of state expenses. So that remains the same. There is a new provision, though, that in the amendments that were added today, that would allow outside of the per capita cap, the federal government might step in and add additional money in the event that the state were facing some kind of a public health emergency or an outbreak such as a Zika virus.
So that an acute health emergency wouldn't strain that per capita cap right off the bat then under
that? That is what is contemplated with this additional fund that's in there, yes.
Let's take a caller now. Ronnie is with us in Germantown. Ronnie, hi.
Hi, how are you? I just want to find out what's going on with Medicare, because all the talk is about Medicaid and other cuts. How is Medicare going to be affected? Answer offline.
Donna, Medicare.
Yeah. So, Ronnie, I know a lot of people have that concern, and let me just say a couple things about that. Under the previous Senate bill, there was a lot of attention paid to a tax cut that had existed that would have affected the sustainability of the Medicare Trust Fund, and that tax cut has actually been removed under today's amendments. So that is actually one thing that does improve. However, there is a concern for the Medicare population in that many people who have Medicare also rely on Medicaid for their long-term care and their long-term support services, so their activities of daily living or other kinds of supports they may need in the community. They actually get that through Medicaid. And many people don't realize that actually most of Medicaid funds are spent on the elderly and the disabled, who are as well Medicare eligible. So the changes that we see in Medicaid will substantially affect the Medicare population as well.
We're talking to Donna Friedsam. Thanks for that call, Ronnie. Donna's a researcher and health policy director at UW-Madison's Population Health Institute. We're looking at some of the changes in the latest version of the Republican Senate health care bill.
And you can join the conversation by calling 800-642-1234. You can post on the Central Time Facebook page. Do you support the continuing effort to replace Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act? Are you pleased with the revisions, like a stability fund to keep down premiums? And what about the changes to Medicaid? Are you concerned about how those changes will affect you? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're picking up our conversation with Donna Friedsam, researcher and health policy director at UW-Madison's Population Health Institute. We're looking at the latest version of the Senate Republican health care bill and what kind of changes it could bring.
Tell us what you think at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. What do you think of the latest effort to replace Obamacare? What do you think of the slimmed down benefit requirements for insurers? Tell us what you think at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll go right back to our callers. Rod is on the line in Madison. Rod, hi.
Hi. Yeah, see, the question that I had, well, actually there's two, but the main one was, I just got onto Medicare 3 months ago. I turned 65. How is what they're talking about doing now and with all these cuts to Medicare, Medicaid, and those type of things, are those things going to start affecting everybody who's already in the system, or are these things that are going to be future things and it's not going to affect our current coverage for us and, of course, until we're gone?
Rod, thanks for the call. And Donna, from what you were saying earlier, it sounds like the Medicare part of it for Rod might not change. But if he's in a situation where he'd need Medicaid along with that, he might see some changes.
Absolutely. This will affect people, anybody. This is not something where people who are currently enrolled will get grandfathered in with their current coverage. It will affect people who, as the provisions take effect, everybody who's in the program will be under the provisions as they take effect. And with regard to Medicare, anybody who's in Medicare will be affected by the long-term sustainability of the Medicare program. This bill that we have before us this week doesn't directly speak to the Medicare program, except to the degree that Medicare and Medicaid are very closely tied, particularly, as I note, because many Medicare members also rely on Medicaid for long-term support services.
Rod, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Peter in Madison. Peter, hi.
Hi. I'm really disappointed with the bill that's been introduced. One aspect of it that I think is actually quite disappointing is that when Trump was running for president, he said he was going to use the purchasing power of the federal government to negotiate better prescription drug prices through Medicare. And there's absolutely nothing in this bill that does anything about prescription drug prices at all. So I feel like that's one aspect of this that Trump ran on that he now is his campaign promise didn't come through on.
Peter, thanks for the call. Donna, do we see much of anything on prescription drug pricing in any incarnation of the House or Senate healthcare bills?
Not what's being addressed currently. No.
And there have been legislative efforts, I know, to at least introduce bills on prescription drug pricing, targeting those big price increases on special kinds of medications. Is there a lot of action outside of this healthcare bill?
There has been discussion, but the kind of action that I think the caller was referring to is not occurring.
Peter, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Mary Kay with us in Milwaukee. Mary Kay, hi.
Hi there. I have a question for your guest. Given the policy, the way it's going to be going out as of right now, it seems as though, from what she said, people would have an opportunity under some conditions to choose to have a stripped-down plan, kind of a bare-bones plan. And they may or not get decent coverage because the insurer would have the right to make a decision about what they would offer. My question is, if people buy those plans, and many people had those before the Obamacare was passed, my daughter had one of them, and what happens if they get very ill and require care for something that's not included in one of those plans? Doesn't that mean that those people who are being forced to purchase more expensive plans because of existing conditions, et cetera, the poor, some of the working poor, and that, aren't they going to be bearing the burden of this? Because somebody has to pay for that.
Mary Kay, thanks for the call. Donna, how do you see that playing out?
I think those points are very observant. Ultimately, if people purchase those slimmed down plans that don't have the full coverage, if something happens to them that is not within the scope of coverage, they will not be able to get have that paid for. And as well, they may have their coverage rescinded even. So, and the coverage under the slimmed down plans would not count as creditable coverage for not for pre-existing condition continuous coverage, and that's a very complex thing way of saying that they would have to wait 6 months before they could get coverage, more comprehensive coverage for a pre-existing condition. Even after that, they essentially would have to get their treatment in some kind of uncompensated care manner, and the cost of that treatment would fall on the healthcare system. And as your caller notes, ultimately those costs get absorbed across the board by mostly by people with some kind of employer-sponsored coverage and the like.
Mary Kay, thanks for the call. We're talking to Donna Friedsum from the UW-Madison Population Health Institute, looking at the latest incarnation of the Senate Republican health care plan. Back to our callers at 800-642-1234. We've got Charlie with us in Milwaukee. Charlie, hi.
Hi, thank you. A question that I have regarding all the health care plans is, one, why not just increase the mandate so that people who basically are avoiding the health care costs are taxed appropriately with the other people who are obtaining health insurance? And second, how much of this is also, you hear so many different sides and so many plans, how much of this is politics as opposed to pure people saying, how do we solve this so that we get a good plan and a good way going forward?
Charlie, thanks for the call. So part one there, boost the mandate penalties, basically, Charlie's saying, I think, but the Republican plan's going away from the mandate in the first place, right, Donna?
Yeah, the mandate was a very controversial and unpopular part of the Affordable Care Act, but people really do like being able to have the protection of getting coverage regardless of pre-existing condition. So the difficult policy piece of all this, and that's making it difficult to come to a solution, is how do you get healthy young people to participate in the market without a mandate, while you require insurance companies to accept all people without pre-existing conditions. And whether this is politics, there certainly are some politics involved, but really this is a very difficult policy solution to come up with in a country where we have different values, a very broad base of perspectives around what is the role for government and how much tolerance people have for government mandates.
Thanks, Charlie. Terry is with us next in Green Bay. Terry, hi.
Hi. Thank you, Donna, for all your expertise, but this question, no question for you, really, but I'm just getting upset about the conversation. We talk about risk corridors and tax subsidies and deductibles and premiums and health savings accounts and high risk and individual mandate. I just want to be able to walk into a hospital, not have a bill, have comprehensive coverage, and just walk out. That's what I want. And I think that's what anybody wants. And we need to get above the fray of all this nitty-gritty, because we're going to be tackling the healthcare situation another 2 years from now when Democrats start taking over the House and stuff like that.
Terry, thanks for the call. Is there a way to cut through the Gordian knot here, Donna, and have a real simple solution like Terry's talking about?
Well, what I would suggest, and I would go back to my previous comment, is that we are a big country with a lot of different perspectives, and certainly this is one of those perspectives. And other people would say, no, that's not a solution, that that people would not utilize their care with judiciously, and that people need to have incentives about how to use care when they need it and when they don't need it. And there's all kinds of debate about this and that. So, we have to remember that we have 1/6 of our economy tied up in this, and there's a lot of different financial interests concerning who's using care and who's making their salary on care. And so that's why it's very difficult for us to get here to there. But what I would
I have to jump in, Donna, because we are out of time. Thanks so much to Donna Friedsum from the UW-Madison Population Health Institute.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, a lawsuit challenges President Trump for blocking followers on Twitter. We'll look at the uncharted First Amendment landscape of politics.
And on Food Friday, we'll get recipes and guidelines for making delicious and nutritious smoothies and juices.
That's coming up tomorrow on Central Time.